Welcome to Kingston Reid's Word to the Wise podcast series for HR and safety professionals.
Welcome to our safety and regulatory podcast series for October 2024, which runs together with the National Safe Work Month. I'm Michael Stutley, and I'm joined by John Macris, a partner and our National Head of Safety and Regulatory Practice, and Liam Fraser, one of our partners in Queensland. It's great to have you both here.
Oh, thank you, Michael. Great to be here. It's John Macris here from the Sydney office, and a great opportunity to talk about psychosocial risks in National Safe Work Month.
Yeah, thanks, Michael. Liam Fraser here, a partner from Queensland. Yeah, really looking forward to the opportunity to take advantage of this important discussion in National Safe Work Month.
Excellent. So to kick it off, what are we going to talk about today? Topic is navigating the quagmire of psychosocial risks. So we've all heard these terms for some time now, but let's quickly take a step back and understand what is a psychosocial risk. Well, the legislation defines it helpfully, or probably unhelpfully by the end of this podcast, as a risk to the health or safety of a worker or other person arising from a psychosocial hazard. So what then is a psychosocial hazard? Well, again, conveniently, the legislation takes us there. And it says that a hazard is one that arises from or relates to the design or management of work, the work environment, plant at a workplace, or workplace interactions or behaviours, and which may cause psychological harm. Naturally, this is very broad, but and probably easy enough to identify direct psychosocial hazards, but it gets very difficult when we consider indirect hazards, which might extend to the performance reviews, for example, and various workplace interactions. We know that there can be organisational factors such as workplace culture, leadership, work design, etc. But there are also environmental factors such as noise, temperature, and remoteness. But what I don't think that we have properly grappled with is the interaction of those workplace-related matters with personal factors and how those personal factors may contribute or exacerbate the workplace factors.
Yeah, and that's a good point that you raise, Michael. One of the issues around psychosocial hazards, of course, is the legislation tells us how they might arise, but not what they actually are. So we're actually seeing cases at the moment which are arising from, for example, misconduct investigations. We've got one at the moment where someone has an issue with the way the investigation was conducted, and then the allegation is that the person has been exposed to a psychosocial hazard, and it's not clear whether that needs to be a recognisable medical condition or something else. And we're also seeing cases arise from other things like harassment and workplace suicides, well, alleged workplace suicides, and exposure to occupational violence. And also we're seeing cases where people aren't interacting, and is an individual idiosyncratic response enough, or does it have to be some type of medical condition? So it's a really difficult area that employers need to navigate.
And to take this a little further, consider the various workplaces where a psychosocial hazard could arise. We know workplace is any location in which work is carried out. For a PCBU, for example, it could be a home office. So the question is, to what extent personal circumstances factor into, precipitate, or result in a psychosocial hazard? Liam, have you come across this?
Yeah, we certainly have, Michael. It's something that we've encountered a few times now, of investigations being triggered by disputes or, as John was saying, the sort of idiosyncratic interactions between staff, and particularly where those people are remote workers, communicating via electronic communication. And there's really limited visibility for an employer or a duty holder in this case to have any visibility over those interactions and to kind of police them. So what you're seeing is that it's usually too late for the duty holder to do anything proactive to manage those risks. And that's a real challenge when you're being required to apply the hierarchy of controls to address these hazards.
That's a very good point. Now, I know I'm not alone in this, but in WA, we are certainly seeing an increase in regulator inquiries, and more so in relation to the reporting of incidents which may cause, and there's that term again, may cause, or had the potential to cause psychological harm. It's obviously a very difficult exercise for employers where there is no clear line in the sand. For example, how do you actually determine the threshold of whether something may cause psychological harm? John, Liam, are either of you seeing this play out right now through regulatory inquiries?
Yeah, we are. We're particularly these harms may be caused is a really interesting one. We're seeing in New South Wales a lot of activity by the regulator. They've introduced and published a psychosocial hazard strategy for the next couple of years. And that basically says that they're going to come out and visit workplaces, even if it is for another incident, for example, a forklift accident. They're still going to ask for how people are meeting their obligations in the psychosocial space with not a lot of guidance on how you do it. You know, in New South Wales, we're hearing a lot of referencing in relation to follow the code of practice, but it itself has some inconsistencies and some grey in areas that need to be focused on. The other interesting thing we're seeing in New South Wales, and we're probably going to see this nationally, is they're talking about changing the notification provisions so that, you know, at the moment you notify certain notifiable incidents, for example, at admission overnight in hospital or admission as an inpatient. And they're talking about saying, well, if someone's been off for a psychosocial issue for more than an extended period, 10 or 15 days, that may be notifiable. Something like a suicide that happens at work, whether it's work-related or not, should be automatically notifiable. So we're going to see probably more regulatory inquiry. And at the moment, I can only talk about New South Wales now, but we're seeing a lot of that inquiry right now.
And I guess from the Queensland experience, we're seeing a very similar situation with inspectors referring to the code of practice, and the situation in Queensland is a little different. Codes of practice are effectively law up here, so you need to comply with the code or do better. So the grey areas that you're talking about, John, create some real areas of risk for employers because there's not a very clear set of instructions often around how to manage these hazards. Probably the other thing that we're seeing is an increase in inspectors wanting to know how a duty holder is consulting with any health and safety representatives. And in Queensland, there was a review done about the Work Health and Safety Act, and it recommended some changes to powers for health and safety representatives and extending some powers for them. And now we're really starting to see the inspectorate coming through and wanting to see how PCBUs are actually engaging with HSRs and wanting HSRs to take a more active role in pointing out psychosocial hazards. And I think that that's probably an area where things could get quite murky, particularly if you've got HSRs issuing provisional improvement notices about psychosocial hazards. And it's quite understandable for a PIN to be issued about a fall from height risk. It's quite another thing to imagine PINs being issued for idiosyncratic psychosocial hazards. So that's something that I think is going to really create some challenges as we see this area develop over the next couple of years, I would say.
So wading through this quagmire then, we understand the risk management process, and it generally requires us to identify the hazard, assess the risk, control the risk, and monitor and review the effectiveness. But where I think we have the biggest challenge is doing this on a scale involving any more than, say, 5 workers. Now, that's a bit tongue-in-cheek, but seriously, how do we work through a risk management process which has so much variability? Because we're all unique individuals with our own background stresses and triggers. John, how do we wade through it?
Michael, that's the million-dollar question. It's really difficult to these a range of hazards, which don't traditionally fit into the neat physical hazards, where you can easily identify, assess, control and review. These are much more difficult because of the individual nature of responses versus the legal systematic approach that's required.
So on that, Liam, in Queensland, you have just had some regulatory amendments earlier this month in relation to unlawful harassment specifically. And from my understanding, that requires PCBUs to have regard to all relevant matters in relation to the risk of unlawful harassment. I think the requirement expressly includes actually having regard to matters relating to characteristics of workers, such as workers' age, gender, and the workplace or the work environment, such as, for example, lack of diversity in that scenario. Now, the listed characteristics are not exhaustive and not obviously intended to provide examples that could be considered by a PCBU when determining the relevant characteristics that may increase the risk of unlawful harassment, for example. This seems to be heading in the direction that we're discussing right now and that John's just raised in relation to unique individual backgrounds, do you see this expanding beyond unlawful harassment?
Yeah, it is a real developing area, Michael, and it is probably something where, as John mentioned, there's incredible tension between the requirement to do things at an individual level and then also systematising this and having it reasonably practicable. And some of those changes that I mentioned earlier were to bring in a requirement which is going to be effective from the 1st of March 2025 to require PCBUs to prepare and implement a plan to manage the identified risk to health and safety of workers or other persons from unlawful harassment at work. And that's going to require the plan to be in writing, state the identified risks, and again, talk about control measures and describe consultation and those sorts of matters. So I think there is going to be an inherent tension between this requirement to have a written plan that does a lot of things to describe in very general terms what a PCBU is doing, and then the tension from inspectors requiring almost individualised risk assessments down to a particular set of circumstances. I'd like to think that the requirement for managing unlawful harassment can be confined to what we can obviously see and hear around the unlawful harassment. But that's not something that I think has really been contemplated yet. I suspect that you know, this requirement to have a sexual harassment management plan is probably something that will become almost de facto requirements in other jurisdictions. If you've got employees in Queensland, you'll probably have a relatively similar approach in your other jurisdictions.
And John, is this something that you think will land in New South Wales and more broadly nationally?
Yeah, while it hasn't been contemplated, I think it will. I think the Victorian regulators looked at this early on the piece and had touted putting something in place like this, but it hasn't happened. But I think it will. In fact, in New South Wales, we actually have safe work inspectors who sit on a sexual harassment task force, and that's sexual harassment, but they're certainly focused on that issue, and because of its continuing prevalence in the workplace, I do think we'll probably see something more broadly and nationally. And you know, it's something that employers need to proactively manage now anyway, whether you need to do a plan or. But I think Liam's right. I think if there's employers who have to do it in Queensland and have workplaces elsewhere, I think we'll probably see it filtering into workplaces as a matter of course anyway.
Okay, so I thought we could end today's podcast with a prediction for where we all think it will go. I'll go first. I've got two. I think the first one is that WA will not be far off Queensland, and that's aligned with what you've just taken us through, John, in terms of perhaps a national approach in preparing and implementing plans to manage identified risks. But it'll be broader than just those unlawful harassment risks that we were talking about earlier. It will extend to psychosocial risk more broadly. And I predict that we will continue to see battle lines drawn in the form of statutory notices, potentially compliance activities and prosecutions. What about you, John?
Yeah, Michael, I agree. I think what we're going to see is, particularly for employees who haven't seen this yet, and we're seeing this quite a bit in New South Wales, is you know, you will, as an employer, at some point get an inquiry from a regulator on psychosocial issues, whether that's an employer who we have this request for service process in New South Wales where you can make an anonymous inquiry to the regulator and they investigate those, or whether it's because of a workplace interaction or a visit to the workplace by the inspectors. Yeah, the regulators are pretty vocal here. They want to understand what processes organisations have to address those risks, and you know, a heavy focus on the code of practice, and are you meeting those requirements?
What about you, Liam?
Yeah, I think riffing off what John was just saying, my prediction is that any employer in Queensland that gets a visit from an inspector after the 1st of March 2025 is probably going to be asked for a copy of their written sexual harassment management plan, and probably also asked how they consulted with relevant other duty holders or stakeholders or health and safety representatives in how they created that. So that's probably my prediction for Queensland. And if you're right, Michael, that probably won't be far off other jurisdictions having a similar approach.
Great. Thanks both. And thanks to everyone for joining. It's been an interesting first podcast in the series for the National Safe Week.
Yeah, Michael, thanks for putting it together. Stay tuned, everyone, throughout October Safety Month. We will roll out some more podcasts on topical safety issues.
Yeah, we certainly will. And I think given what we were just saying about the likelihood of visits from inspectors about these matters, we'll probably touch on what you need to do when an inspector comes and what you should be looking at when you get one of their notices.